end of the three branches of government. That's our law commission. We've worked on a number of bills this session, and this is the first set of bills that will be before you. This is our fourth session, and it's our third funded session. We're housed at Willamette University College of Law. Willamette University matches the funding that pays for the commission's biennium. So with that, I'd like to start and just explain Senate Bill 235. But my first handout to you is just a list of the five bills that you'll hear today in summary fashion. And then, Senators, members of the committee, my next two handouts are a report that explains Senate Bill 235 and then an attached list of the laws that were referred to in writing this bill. So that handout starts with the ADA section, and it also includes the BOLI rules as well as the CFRs that were relevant to the statute.
You can proceed, Wendy.
Thank you. Senator Burdick, members of the committee, this bill, Senate Bill 235, we've called it the Public Accommodation or Reasonable Accommodation Bill. This bill is intended to codify portions of Title III of the Americans with Disability Act into state statute. The Bureau of Labor and Industry already has rules that are quite similar to these provisions, but the Federal District Court of Oregon has repeatedly held that Oregon's statute is not broad enough to cover the same types of things that are required by the ADA. And that would include the active type things that a place of public accommodation needs to do to provide reasonable accommodations. In other words, the statute presently only says to places of public accommodation, you can't, it just says you can't say if you have a disability, you're not allowed in, that sort of active discrimination, but it doesn't require the further step of removing the step or the barrier that doesn't allow the person in. I think when the legislature adopted the statute, it was intending to follow the ADA, so this bill is just to provide conformance with Title III of the ADA and require that next step. The statute is not particularly detailed in this bill, and we did that because we wanted to leave many of the details to BOLI, as BOLI has already adopted rules in this area. So without further elaboration, I'll just take your questions on that on this bill. But again, it's not to expand the requirements of public accommodations. It's to codify what's already required in federal law.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee?
Thank
you. Senator Ringo.
Thank you. What is the definition of a place of public accommodation?
Senator Ringo, members of the committee, I would ask you to turn your attention to the handout that I gave you on the Americans with Disability Act. It defines it under Section 12181, sub 7. It's including things like inns, hotels, motels, it's those things that affect commerce. Generally, Title III does not apply to government. It's applying to places of public accommodation as they're defined in the ADA. It includes restaurants, theaters are kind of the common place that they're often sued on under the statute, frankly. Auditoriums, convention centers, those types of things.
Just a second, Senator Whitson. Does the public accommodation include like apartments, apartment houses, places for rent?
Senator Burdick, members of the committee, I'm not particularly familiar with that of the housing laws. I think it's a different area.
It wouldn't seem to from this. Council?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, on page 2 of the bill, a place of public accommodation has a meaning given the terms ORS 659A400 states a place of public accommodation subject to exclusion in subsection 2 of this section means any place of service offering to the public accommodations, advantages, facilities, or privileges, whether in the nature of goods, services, lodging, amusements, or otherwise. Subsection 2 states, however, a place of public accommodation does not include any institution, bona fide club, or place of accommodation which is in its nature distinctly private. So you have what the definition is and then the exception.
Okay. Thank you. I guess I presume the private would take that into account. Senator Whitson.
Chair Burdick, Ms. Johnson, is my reading of this then that this bill would extend these limitations to all places of commerce, period. I mean, that's any place or service offering to the public accommodations, advantages, facilities, or privileges for the nature of goods, service, lodging, amusements, and otherwise. I mean, it's everything. So there's no exclusion for any small business. There's no matter how small, this would be for anyone. If you're in business, you would have to provide these services. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's my understanding.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Thank you. I assume you'll be standing by in case there are other questions that come up after the testimony. Next, we have Denise Spielman from Washington County. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Senator Burdick and members of the committee. I'm here with my private personal hat on to give my private personal opinion that you should sign this bill into law. I am a commissioner on the Oregon Disabilities Commission. I am the chair of its ADA committee. In my everyday life, Tuesday through Friday, and today is a vacation day or I would not be here, because as in my regular job, I am not allowed to act as an advocate. I am not a lawyer. I am an ADA technical assistance specialist. I answer a 1-800 line for Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Alaska, giving information to anyone who calls regarding their rights or responsibilities under the law. And if you will indulge me, I would like to clarify the questions that you asked before. Housing is not covered under the ADA except in the public portions. So in an apartment complex, for an example, the parking, if there's parking for visitors, that would be covered. And the rental office itself and the common areas would be covered under the ADA, under public accommodations. Otherwise, it's a fair housing issue. And in addition, you asked about the size of the business, and it applies to all businesses, and it does mean that unless there is undue burden, and a lot of smaller businesses have that out, if you will, not to provide physical accommodation, they should provide their goods and services and programs and activities in an alternate way if they can. So if you need to honk for curb service because your dry cleaner is inaccessible, then that's compliance under the law. The reason that I felt compelled to take a vacation day and come here today is that in the 300 or 400 calls our center gets every month, a significant portion of those calls come from businesses, and they want to know, do we really have to let this service animal in? Do we really have to provide a sign language interpreter? Those kinds of questions. And because that's my job to answer those questions and to help them work through their specific issues, I have found that there's a lot of misinformation out there. And putting this federal law into state statute is going to help businesses tremendously understand what their rights and responsibilities are. In addition to benefiting Oregonians with disabilities, it's going to benefit the businesses as well. You have before you a purple pen, and I did take the liberty of giving you a purple pen, which has our information on it. And I want to let you know that our center, because we work under a federal grant to provide information, provides free training to anyone who calls. So we can help those businesses, and we can be a resource if businesses don't clearly understand what their rights and responsibilities are under the law. All calls are confidential, and we design our trainings to respond to the specific needs of whoever it is who calls us. So I would like to respectfully request that you seriously consider passing this and making things easier for businesses in Oregon.
And it must be particularly tricky for you because the federal law is binding, even though it isn't in our statute. So you had to know two sets of laws to help people, and hopefully this will give you just one set of laws.
Yes.
Thank you. Other questions, Senator Barr?
Thank you. I know, was the amendment yours, or was that?
No.
Okay. I guess I'll have a question about the amendment at a later time, because it's if we're trying to put federal law and codify in state law, I guess my question would be, why are we taking an amendment to take the federal law out of state law and letting Boley define it by rule? It's a lot easier to find a law when it's in a statute book than to have to go up in a rule.
Actually, you know, that's a very good question, and we could bring, this is a law commission amendment, so we could bring Wendy back to answer that question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I can give you enlighten you on that because I was present at the Law Commission meeting where we discussed that, but Ms. Johnson can discuss it with us also. I don't know if you want to do it now or...
Okay. Why don't we wait till we hear the testimony and then we'll take
that. We talked about that for a long while, and there's a reason behind the amendment.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, Kevin O'Reilly. Let's see, are we well accommodated here? Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Kevin O'Reilly. I represent the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America.
Mr. O'Reilly, could you speak up a little bit? Our sound system just doesn't seem to be the best.
Is this working better for you?
That does.
Good.
Thank you.
The committee is being passed out our written testimony for Bill 235, and at this time I'd like to briefly expand on a few of our points. As an organization, Oregon PVA provides education and information not only to citizens but also businesses. When asked by a business, we actually provide a consulting service. Currently, we do this free of charge. We treat the business as our client. We will work with the business, contractors if they've hired them, and we work to look for the best solution for that business. We do it on a case-by-case basis. We don't have a stamp we just hit them with. This bill will help us in the performance of that duty. We mentioned a potential increase in the use of state courts. One suit in a decade would be such an increase. However, we doubt there will be a plethora of lawsuits. Lawsuits generally don't happen. They're difficult to implement and difficult to stay with. A recent example would be, recently I had opportunity to visit two separate offices in the same building. Both had smaller waiting rooms. The first office asked if I was comfortable. The employees asked if I was comfortable. They offered to move chairs so I could sit comfortably in their waiting room. The second office, as one of the employees tried to trip over my feet, asked me to go wait in the hall. They couched this in terms of being for my own convenience, of course, but we both knew I was in their way. Now, as any good businessman will tell you, is that working better? One of the keys to success is customer service, and one of the best forms of advertisement is word of mouth. Will I press an issue with the second office? No. What will I do? I'll give my money to the first guy. And I'm going to recommend them to my friends and family and acquaintances. There are ways to limit potential frivolous lawsuits. You can require mediation, and you can put time limits on when to file. This will cut down on lawsuits a great deal. In our written testimony, we reference all of Oregon's disabled citizens. Even though we feel this bill will and should help all of Oregon's citizens, as a veteran service organization, Oregon PVA is primarily concerned with disabled veterans. One of these concerns is the veteran's ability to integrate back into society. As I'm sure you're all aware, we have many service personnel returning with substantial injuries. Many of these injuries will result in life-altering disabilities. We actively encourage disabled veterans to seek the opportunities they fought to preserve. This means finding work and becoming active in the lives of their community. This bill will codify for them in our state's law our appreciation for their service and sacrifice, and will go a long way in assist them in achieving this goal. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them.
Thank you very much. Are there questions on the committee? Thank you very much, Mr. O'Reilly. Bob Jundiff from the Oregon Advocacy Center. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundiff. I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. The written testimony that it's being handed out right now really addresses the overall social policy for the Americans with Disabilities Act in having a world in which people with disabilities can access all of the same goods and services as any other individual. And I'm not going to repeat that right now. What I would like to do is just talk about a few technical points about where we are and why this bill comes to you. The state law that we are seeking to amend has been in law for some time, and it forbids discrimination against people with disabilities in public accommodations. It's a very spare statute, and over the years, there's been opportunities to interpret it in Oregon, in the state structure. The Bureau of Labor and Industries has interpreted that statute as requiring the provision of removal of barriers or aids and services that are not an unreasonable hardship for a business or entity. So within the Oregon legal structure, that has been the interpretation that we have. Now, there has been some federal court decisions in the Federal District Court of Oregon that have basically said, you know, when we read this statute, it doesn't explicitly state that these sorts of auxiliary aids and services or removal of barriers are required. And so we're not going to read that in because the legislature hasn't explicitly stated it. So what we have here is two different interpretations of a bare-bones statute that's been in Oregon law for some time. Even though that law has been there and Boley has interpreted the law as I explained, there's been no state appellate law interpreting exactly what that law means. So we haven't had an opportunity to have the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals tell us what they think was the legislature's intent when it passed legislation. But we do have a difference of opinion right now. Our position at the Advocacy Center is that having a statute that purports to prohibit discrimination against people with disabilities that does not require the provision of auxiliary aids and services or removal of barriers is meaningless. The entire in the world of disabilities, in order for a person to take advantage of any service, they have to be able either to enter the building, the service, or the service has to be available to them in a way that they can make sense of. The federal law is very flexible on this point. It does not say everybody has to spend a whole pile of money in order to build all sorts of new things. It just says that within reason, a business has to think about ways that it can provide service to a person with disability and then go about doing that. This is a reasonable interpretation, and we think it's one that the Oregon legislature intended originally when it passed the statute. I think that's my testimony.
Okay. Are there questions? Thank you very much. Marcia Oldmiller.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. I'm Marcia Owen Miller. I'm the legal policy advisor for the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. And as has been mentioned, we do have jurisdiction over the statutes that are being amended or would be amended by this legislation. First, I'd like to say that the bills before you today are represent a continuing effort on the part of the Oregon Law Commission to resolve necessary issues regarding Oregon Oregon Revised Statute Chapter 659A and other Oregon civil rights statutes. When they undertook the rewriting of 659 a couple of sessions ago, lots of problems were discovered that were not known or not foreseen, and so we are continuing to look at how this set of laws can be improved and be clarified and that type of thing. The first bill before you today is Senate Bill 235, and first I want to say that Oregon's law prohibiting discrimination against disabled persons by places of public accommodation did predate the Federal Americans with Disabilities Act. So this law was on the books here before the ADA. The ADA, of course, is a very extensive law, and its prohibition on discrimination against disabled persons very clearly includes accommodation, in addition to just not just prohibiting discrimination against those people. It also says you have to accommodate them in order that they may take advantage of the opportunities and goods and services and all those kinds of things. So the ADA really opened up the idea of accommodating people, not just admitting them. After the ADA was enacted, the Bureau amended its administrative rules to require removal of physical barriers to places of public accommodation and to goods and services, as well as providing auxiliary aids. And we did model those changes on the ADA regulations. The authority for those amendments was what is now ORS 659A.805 that authorizes the commissioner to adopt reasonable rules to carry out the purposes of Chapter 659A. The purposes of the chapter include the policy that is found at ORS 659A.103, guaranteeing disabled persons the fullest possible participation in the social and economic life of the state, including using and enjoying places of public accommodation. The policy cannot be fully implemented by merely prohibiting exclusion of disabled persons if disabled persons cannot also enjoy the goods and services the place of public accommodation offers. As the Law Commission testimony and others have pointed out, federal courts hearing cases under the Oregon Public Accommodation Statute have ignored the Bureau's administrative rules and interpreted the statute not to require barrier removal or provision of auxiliary aids. While these cases are not binding on the Bureau, they do make for inconsistent enforcement because we at the Bureau apply our rules in our own contested cases. And as Mr. Joondeff stated, there have been no cases under this law under the Oregon Court of Appeals or the Oregon Supreme Court, so they have not spoken in regard to the Bureau's rules. Further, we feel that the federal cases are misleading to places of public accommodation in that Title III of the ADA does require barrier removal and auxiliary aids. And under that law, individuals may bring suit for injunctive relief and may be awarded attorney fees. And if the U.S. Department of Justice believes that a case indicates a pattern or practice of discrimination, it may investigate and bring suit for injunctive relief and civil penalties of $50,000 or $100,000. So there is exposure on public accommodations who don't understand what their obligations already are under federal law. It's been asked today, what is a place of public accommodation? And, of course, the public accommodation statute in Oregon does go into the definition to a certain extent. I want to expand on that because we have internal policies reflecting not only the definition in statute, but a number of Oregon court cases that have further interpreted it. A place of public accommodation is defined in the statute as any place or service offering to the public accommodations or advantages or facilities or privileges in the nature of goods, services, lodgings, amusements, or otherwise. and it does not include any institution, bona fide club, or place of accommodation, which is in its nature distinctly private. Now we get into the case law. The Oregon Court of Appeals has found that membership organizations are covered if membership is open to the public, and if they are covered in goods and services they may offer to the public. So in other words, although and I'm not saying the courts have said this, but for instance, if the Girl Scouts were found to be not covered, it doesn't mean that they can refuse to sell cookies to whomever they choose. They're out there providing goods and services in the commercial arena. Places of public accommodation do include public agencies, nonprofit organizations, and private entities when they provide goods or services to the general public in what is customarily regarded as a business or commercial activity. And I also want to note that the state is specifically prohibited from discriminating against disabled persons under ORS 659A.142, which was enacted by the last legislature. Oregon courts have found that places of public accommodation do not include sales of wholesale goods not open to the public, contractors that do not advertise their services to the general public, or issuance of insurance policies but do include refusal to accept an application for insurance. So this is as far as the courts have gone in terms of specific interpretation of what is a place of public accommodation. That's what we know at this point. Senate Bill 235, I won't go through the provisions again because they're evident in the bill itself. The Law Commission has determined that details such as definitions of auxiliary aids and readily achievable would be better placed in administrative rules. And the reason for that is that the level of detail in those definitions is high. And typically, and the other thing is that case law could change those definitions. So rather than have all the detail of the disability law spelled out in the statute, if you look at the rest of Oregon's disability laws, that level of detail is not there in other sections. That's left to administrative rulemaking. So that was the commission and the work group's determination as far as why it's been asked, why are these things being removed? These things were being proposed to be put into the law, and then upon further reflection, the Civil Rights Work Group and the Commission determined only some of this should go into law, the rest should be left to administrative rulemaking. They did, however, in place of that language, the proposed amendments would include language saying that this section will be construed to the extent possible in a manner that is consistent with similar provisions of the ADA, and that in accordance with applicable provisions of Chapter 183, the Commissioner of BOLI shall adopt rules necessary for the administration and enforcement of subsection 3, and in adopting these rules, the Commissioner shall consider and to the greatest extent practicable shall adopt the regulations of the U.S. Department of Justice under Title 3. So there is some structure to how the Bureau would promulgate any further rules. Our rules to date are our best good faith effort to parallel the federal regulations. That's where we got the language of the current Oregon rules. We would, of course, should this bill pass, be undertaking a review to further decide are we close enough to the federal regulations. I believe that covers everything I had to say about Senate Bill 235. I'm happy to answer further questions. The Bureau works with this law a lot. We've done a lot of thinking about it. And we do believe that having these provisions set out into law will be beneficial to places of public accommodation as well as to disabled persons and the public at large, because right now it's not evident what a place of public accommodation would need to do specifically to enable the enjoyment of those goods or services by disabled persons. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Wendy, maybe you could come up and join her and we can address, unless Senator Byer, unless your issues have been addressed already. Senator Walker, did you want to go join them and on this discussion of the amendment, or would you rather just speak from here?
Madam Chair, I can just speak from here. Ms. Allmiller addressed it, I believe, but the question is that the federal law changes, and we can't we can't pass, and we had great discussion with Professor Lindy about this, and who's also a commissioner on the Law Commission, but and he's a former justice. But you cannot draft an Oregon statute that takes into account future changes in federal law. So we put in statute what we can that is static, and then we leave it up to the Bureau to draft administrative rules to change as the federal law changes. But the whole point in Senate Bill 235 is because right now the courts are ignoring administrative rules because they want us to beef up our statutes. They go first to the statutes, then the administrative rules. So we're trying to make it all blend, and that's why we took out the reference, and you see that in the amendment, Senator. I hope that answers your question.
Madam Chair, it answers my question as to the logic as to why the Law Commission or Senator Walker may want to do this, but it doesn't answer the question that because it's testified, it was testified that one of the reasons to do this is so that it is easier for businesses to follow the law or to know what the laws are. And as a business, it's a much easier to know if it's in a statute and to look at a statute rather than have to wonder about where the OAR is, which one of the 10-digit number I might find it in, and how often it's going to change. If it's in statute, it only can change when the legislature is in session. Much like our laws, not rules, but our laws on reconnecting to the federal tax code. Senator Watkins is exactly right. We can't pass a law that says we automatically connect to the federal tax code. That's why we do a roll-in reconnect. Every other year, we have to pass a bill that updates our statutes to the federal tax codes if we want to reconnect with them. And I just think if the purpose of the bill is to make it, to bring our statutes in line with federal statutes, and they are statutes, not rules, am I right? They're federal statutes. If the purpose of the bill is to bring our statutes in line with federal statutes and to make it easier for businesses to know what those laws are so they get easier for them to, follow them, it seems like we should keep the detail in the statute.
Wendy, did you want to respond to that?
Thank you, Senator Burdick, Senator Beyer. I understand your concern about putting more detail into the statute. I think the rationale of the commissioners and the work group was that by referencing the ADA specifically in the amendment, it at least puts businesses on notice that there is something called the Americans with Disability Act out there and that this statute was intended to be in line with that federal law. The federal law changes all the time, and businesses don't have notice of that presently in statute. So having that reference in statute will help. The reality is that the ADA law keeps changing, and by allowing BOLI to provide administrative rules, it will be kept up to date, easier for businesses to follow. And if you look at the CFRs in this area, they're long and they're very complicated, and there's just lots and lots of details. So if there are particular issues that are going to have to be dealt with, you're going to have to go to the CFRs anyway, and at least this statute will direct you to that place.
Ms. Oldmiller, what would a business do to find out what their requirements are under this?
Well, first of all, I want to point out that as drafted, the bill would point out that the Bureau of Labor and Industries is authorized to do rules, so that would put the reader on notice that there are administrative rules in a state agency. That is not dissimilar to the Oregon Family Leave Act and many other provisions of employment laws where they refer to the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and many businesses are used to looking to us for, the rest of the story. Where are the rules? Are there policies? That type of thing. So we also have a technical assistance division that does nothing but answer questions of businesses about how to comply with our laws. The hotline is free, and they answer dozens of calls a day, hundreds of calls a week. They also provide seminars, handouts, publications for all the laws that we enforce, and this would be one of them. So there are some ways that businesses could become familiar with what this requires. As well, there are many entities out there that help coach businesses on ADA compliance. This would be square on with ADA requirements. So, in fact, those businesses are probably already under ADA, and if they don't know about that, this would give them some additional information at the state level and some additional resources on that kind of compliance.
So from a business standpoint, they would have to go the extra step of going, they'd go to the statute or have their lawyer go to the statute, and then they'd have to go to the extra step of contacting BOLI and finding out where the rules are. And
or they could, well, contact us or go to the website. You know, state administrative rules, you know, are known to most, if not all, attorneys who work for businesses. So I don't want to be glib. I know that there are small businesses out there and folks in business without access to legal counsel all the time that would need to be doing this for themselves. But we do try to make ourselves available to those very kinds of entities for that reason. This would be no different from the many, many other requirements, civil rights requirements on businesses.
Okay. Senator Byer, did you have any more follow-up on that?
Well, I guess I do. I mean, I would ask the question, maybe I'll start with a statement or ask, I don't know how to start this, but by reading your testimony, I assume that your rules are now outside of statutory authority.
We consider them to be within statutory authority by reason of the rationale that I talked about, which is that if you look at the policy purpose of the disability statutes, it says the use and enjoyment of public accommodations. And it's our interpretation that to get the enjoyment of public accommodations, you would have to be able to have access to the goods and services, meaningful access, not just be able to not be refused service or refused sale of the goods, but in fact you'd have to be able to have something in place that says this is how that access could happen.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that you may think your rules are not in conflict with statute, but your testimony says federal courts have ignored the rules, administrative rules, and interpretive Oregon's public accommodation statutes not to require border removal. So I guess your interpretation may be that your rules are okay, but the courts, according to your testimony, said they aren't.
Well, the way, Madam Chair, Senator Byer, the way that the line of authority falls, we would be bound if it were, for instance, the Oregon Supreme Court or the Oregon Court of Appeals. Federal courts make pronouncements on state law and interpretations of state law that agencies may or may not be bound by. And with regard to what the federal district courts have said about this, in technical terms, we're not bound by it. And in fact, it would be, we felt, really unhelpful to all of a sudden do away with our regulations and have nothing there. So I suppose, you know, reasonable people could debate this point, but I'm simply putting our point of view out there.
I guess that, to my point, if, and I don't know if the language of this proposed amendment would satisfy it, maybe it does, but another issue becomes if you read the detail out of the statute, rely on the statute, rely on the rule to follow the federal law, but the statute does not allow that. You may be, by adopting this, you may be putting the rules out of conformity with the statutes again.
Okay. I think our counsel had a comment on that.
Madam Chair, Marcy Omar, I assume that this issue gets before the federal court because someone is contending as a violation of federal law and state law, and it's brought in federal district court. Is that correct?
I believe so. I believe these are cases that were brought under federal and state law together.
And assume further that what the court is doing is interpreting federal and state law at the same time.
Council Taylor, Senator Burdick, members of the committee, yes.
And what it's saying is that federal law in this particular area is broader than state law?
Yes.
Okay.
And
if I'm correct, because they're interpreting state law, it's not binding on a state agency because we've already said it's not an Oregon Court of Appeals, a Supreme Court, and it doesn't involve a federal question?
That's correct.
Thanks.
Thank you. Senator Byrd, any more? Thank you very much. Senator Whitsitt?
Chair Burdick, Ms. Johnson, we had earlier testimony that stated that this law would establish access to state courts. Could you expand on that thought, please?
Senator Whitsitt, I'm not sure I understand the question. This bill is intended to, in effect, reverse those federal district court decisions that found that Oregon statute wasn't as broad. But this issue has not been decided in state court, meaning state appellate courts, meaning the Oregon Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals. As Counsel Taylor explained, you can bring these matters in either state court or federal court, and there isn't a published decision yet in state court on this statute.
Chair Burdick, does that mean that it simply hasn't been tested in state court yet?
Correct.
But the ability to bring cases in state court has always been there.
Well, but Chair Burdick, that begs the question, why has it never been brought in state court?
Chair Burdick, Senator Whitsitt, we really can't say. You know, as the agency of jurisdiction, it's always interesting to us to, you know, we always read the opinions of the Oregon Supreme Court and Court of Appeals to see what people are bringing under our, what we call our statutes of jurisdiction, as private rights, because we're simply not involved. Sometimes a complaint has come through us first and been investigated by us, and then the complainant chooses to take that complaint to court, but we're not involved in that decision. So as far as people's, you know, whether people have tried to bring cases in state court and haven't been able to for some reason, we would not be aware of that because we wouldn't have been involved in it.
One further question.
Someone follow you.
You can stop sucking now, Roger.
Fresh air.
Our moment of fresh air. Pardon the interruption. Go ahead.
Senator Burdick, Senator Woodson, I would just add that it doesn't mean that there hasn't been a claim brought in state court. It just means it hasn't been appealed. So it could have been brought in circuit court, but it just hasn't been appealed, and so there's not a published decision in state court on this issue.
The one further question, Chair Burdick, this is more of a perception that it would become easier to access state courts than the actual case.
That's the intent, Senator Whitsitt, yes. It's just to make it clear that it's that federal law and state law are the same.
Other questions? Thank you very much. So we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 235 and open the hearing on Senate Bill 236. And this is my rare opportunity to act as counsel. This clarifies that a civil action for discrimination in a place of public accommodation or a civil action for aiding and abetting discrimination in a place of public accommodation must be commenced within 1 year of the occurrence of the unlawful practice. And this applies to causes of action occurring on or after the effective date of the act. Wendy, you're on again. And Marcia, you are also signed up for for all of these bills, so why don't you come on up and the two of you can work in tandem from here on out.
Members of the committee, I'm providing for you again a report from the Law Commission that explains Senate Bill 236. This one's a lot simpler than the last bill, but it's again involving places of public accommodation. Presently, there's no statute of limitations to bring a suit in court. As Marsha Olemiller from Boley explained earlier, Boley has jurisdiction over this area as well. You can bring a suit in either with Boley or the circuit court. There's not a statute of limitations for bringing that complaint in court. The civil rights work group looked at the issue and decided it could be presently 1 year, it could be 5 years, it could be 10 years. Because Oregon statute provides a number of default statutes, there's a tort
statute of limitations of 5 years. That's a default. And there's a general 10-year statute of limitations as a default. Every right should have a statute of limitations as well as clear remedies. So the Law Commission picked up this area of law just to add in a statute of limitations so it would be clear. A statute of limitations provides finality to both sides, both the employer and the employee. If we went with 1 year, which is the standard statute of limitations for unlawful employment discrimination claims. Now, public accommodations claims are a little bit different than employment, but they're similar enough, and attorneys often practice in the same area, and 1 year, it seems like enough time to get into court and is reasonable for both sides.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions? Ms. Ola-Miller, do you have any further comment on this?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I really don't have anything further to add.
Okay. Thank you. That was easy. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 236. We'll open a hearing on Senate Bill 237, same cast of characters. This time I'm going to skip the summary. I'll let Ms. Johnson start here.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, again, this is a statute of limitations bill. Senate Bill 237 adds in a statute of limitations for bringing a complaint in court on claims of discrimination based on an occupational safety and health discrimination claim, in other words, an OSHA claim. You have a choice of bringing a suit in boldly using the administrative procedures or bringing it in court. There's not a statute of limitations for bringing that action in court. We've discussed this issue with the Oregon OSHA, as well as with Foley and members of our work group. Originally, we thought that 180 days might work. I put in the request to legislative council for that, kind of splitting the difference. We later decided that a year wouldn't be more consistent with the other unlawful discrimination claims and allow folks to really to get an attorney and to complete a proper investigation. So, again, this is putting a statute of limitations for a violation of that employers make on discriminating against an employee or a prospective employee for making a health and safety complaint concerning their workplace.
Thank you. Any questions, Ms. Johnson? Do you have anything to add? Okay. Thank you very much.
No, I have a question.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. This bill looks surprisingly similar to a bill that's in Commerce.
Senator Beyer, I can't hear you.
I said this bill looks surprisingly similar to a bill that's in the Commerce Committee brought by Burley, where there's a slight difference. The one in with the amendment, it's different. I think as the bill is printed, it's the same bill, isn't it, that is in the Commerce Committee?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, the bill that's before Commerce today, I believe, would change the statute of limitations for bringing a BOLI complaint from the current 30 days to 90 days. This changes the or creates a statute of limitations that apparently never existed for taking a complaint to court from nothing to 1 year. That's the relationship between these two. There is no relationship in their development. The commission sponsors this bill, and the Bureau of Labor and Industry sponsors the other bill. And Oregon OSHA is aware of and has worked with us on both of them.
I see.
Senator Brzezinski, would you elucidate for all of us?
Yeah. The difference is, as declarant has said, is that this bill here dealt with setting the statute of limitations to get a claim before a court, a judicial body. The other one that's before us that actually is on our docket today for a work session is whether or not the statute of limitations should be increased from 30 days to 90 days to have a complaint filed with the agency as compared to a court action. And apparently the Law Commission must have been working on this during the interim period that came up with the understanding or realization that there isn't any statute of limitations. So currently you could potentially have a default up to maybe up to 10 years.
Correct.
And so this is actually going to put a finality that you have to bring the claim through a court action within a one-year period or you lose that right. So this is actually for business, gives a certainty of when the claim could be filed, and it's one-tenth of what could potentially be used based on some of the default statutes that we currently have in civil law. that makes a difference.
I would like to thank the chair of the Commerce Committee for that clarification. Thank you, Senator.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Walker,
the good chair of that committee is exactly right. And we had a discussion about maybe combining the two bills, but we just left it as it was. Because, they're really two separate issues, but good eye, Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair,
Senator Beyer.
I'd have to ask, I don't know if the question should be more directed to Senator Przewodniczący or to the witnesses, but is it the same action that is being, that's being challenged, whatever it is, not challenged, but sued or brought action for it? I mean, it's the same violation, so a person, an employer, can be taken either to court or to bully for the same violation?
Which they current, if I should, they that, can currently.
That's what I'm saying. It could. So it's the same violations that we're speaking about.
It's basically the forum. One forum is through an agency process, which actually gives the administrative rule process that's worked out, and before you can go to the court, you have to extinguish or use that process. Or if you, as a claimant, wanted to initiate the action in a state court, you'd have to follow these rules to get in the court. But I believe the cause of action could be the same, meaning the underlying issue that's being alleged between the two.
Well, that far, that goes way beyond the subject matter we're doing now. That's very typical for a number of areas of law. Is
yeah,
that correct?
Right. I mean, there's a lot of opportunity for a claimant to go either or through the agency process and or through the court process.
Okay, Senator?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions from the
Senator Burdick, I would just
comments,
add,
Ms. Johnson?
I would just add that the Law Commission picked up this particular project because there was a gap in the law. There was not a statute of limitations for courts, and that's why we sponsored this bill. The Boley bill that's in the Commerce Committee is to change existing law, so that's the difference. They do involve the same type of claim for a discrimination claim based on workplace discrimination of safety violations, but we are filling a gap in the law because that's the Commission's role, is to improve the law, fill gaps in the law, fix ambiguities and such.
Yeah, it's a coincidence that they happen on
right.
the same day. We'll have this almost all of this committee goes right to Commerce, so I'm sure this discussion will continue. Thank you.
Continue at 3:10.
Exactly.
Hearing and see.
So we'll take the whole crowd with us here.
Is that an advertising plug?
Come on, come on.
Okay, this commercial is over, Senator Przewodniczący. All right, thank you very much. Are there other questions or comments? Okay, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 237 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 238. Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
I'm not Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, didn't we just have a hearing on 236?
Yes, we did, and you were gone, and I did
okay.
the summary.
So that's
one
is 236.
It was a
I
short
one.
Excellent job.
I heard the same thing out from the... Madam Chair, members of the committee, since the statute of limitations and employment safety lawsuit at 182...
We're already going to be on you.
238. We move fast, counsel. You
yes,
have
you
to
do.
Come back.
You never know
Jeez,
what happens.
What can I say? I thought maybe that was... Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 238...
Senate Bill 238. You're all here now, Council. We've done the impossible. We've rattled the council.
Yeah, you have. You have. Let me find my file.
The institution shaking.
I think I might be able to provide some.
Here you go. How's that?
There you go.
Thank you. Clarifies that the volunteer firefighters and legislators who request a leave of absence from work to perform the respective duties of persons who use tobacco products off a job have a right to injunctive, compensatory, and punitive damages. You have a dash one set of amendments remove the punitive damages part. If the employer discriminates against them for requesting leave or using tobacco products.
Okay, this is a fun one.
I'm just talking about
go ahead, Wendy, and take this one away.
Yeah. This one will be a little bit of discussion, Madam Chair.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, this is an interesting bill because of the grouping of folks that we're looking at here. This bill deals with discrimination claims of firefighters, tobacco users, and members of the Legislative Assembly. It's quite a cast of characters, as you might be amused by. We had no idea that some of these issues might get hotter as when they were spotted in 2001. The legislature has provided that discrimination against these three different groups is an unlawful employment discrimination practice. We found those three did not have a remedy, though, listed in statute. And so back in 2001, when that issue was identified, we put it on our list to carry over, and then this session we decided to put those categories into the list. If you look at Senate Bill 238, you'll see lots and lots of statutes listed. Each one of those represents a different type of employment discrimination. You see those listed in subsection 2 and subsection 3 of section 1. Initially, when the work group looked at these issues, the big decision was whether to put these different types of claims under sub 2 and or under sub 3, or in addition to sub 3. As you'll see from the introduced bill, we put them under both, and this would provide the most extensive remedies that are allowed. The report that I just handed out to you tries to put in bullet point form what those rights are. It's on page 4 of the report. Under section 2, you're allowed a civil action in court to be tried before a judge. You're allowed injunctive relief, prevailing party costs and attorney fees, and other equitable remedies, which would include reinstatement, hiring, and back pay. Those claims that are listed under subsection 3 are in the next set of bulleted points on page 4 of my report. That would allow you the same remedies above in section 1, but it would also allow you a jury trial, compensatory damages, or $200, whichever is greater, and punitive damages. If you turn the page on the bill, you'll see there's also a subsection 4. That provides sort of a compromise area for damages, and I've described that on page 5 of the report. The subsection 4 types of claims that are listed get the sub 1 remedies and also give you compensatory damages or $250. Does not give you a jury trial, does not provide for punitive damages. The commission had a long discussion about these issues, and as you might imagine, tobacco users did not have the same sympathy that the legislative members who are discriminated against because of their service, nor did...
It depends on who you talk to.
And volunteer firefighters also, there was more sympathy to them than the tobacco users. So the commission had a great discussion and ultimately decided, as reflected in your amendments before you, to not provide the subsection 3 remedies to any of the three, the firefighters, tobacco users, or legislative assembly members. But they did decide to put them all under subsection 2, which gives them the subsection 1 remedies. And for the firefighters and legislative assembly members to sort of split the difference and provide compensatory damages. So that's what you have before you in terms of the amendments. Basically, the commission decided that adding punitive damages and providing a jury trial is just too costly. And looking at the different types of remedies, there wasn't a lot of rationale for why some things are in sub 2 and some things are in sub 3 presently. So it really is a policy decision. Right now, it doesn't define what the remedies are for these three classes, but the legislature has defined them as unlawful employment discrimination. And as I explained before, it's important for all rights to be clear on what the statute of limitations are and what the remedies are. And right now, it's not clear in Oregon what those remedies are.
Okay. Do us a favor, if you would, and just list the remedies that are available for all three categories. Let's start for volunteer firefighters.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as drafted
with the amendment.
With the amendments. If you look at the report, I think it's easier than trying to read the statute. With the amendments, they would get the bulleted points that are at the top of page 4, which includes this is the firefighters and the legislative assembly members. They would get a right to an action circuit court before a judge. They'd also get injunctive relief, prevailing party costs and attorney fees, and other equitable relief as may be appropriate, which includes reinstatement, hiring, if the person's a prospective employee, and back pay. And then in addition, they would get the compensatory damages are $250. That's on page 5 of the report.
Okay, wait a second. I'm kind of lost
so the,
here.
The bulleted at the top of page 4 and the bulleted on page 5 is what we're proposing legislative assembly members and volunteer firefighters would receive.
Okay, so that would be compensatory damages. just list them.
Injunctive relief. Equitable relief. And a bench trial.
A bench trial.
Okay. And costs and attorney fees.
So, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Prezansky.
When I was reading through this bill, I was trying to figure out what remedies does a volunteer firefighter who serves in the legislature who smokes get.
Well, we've had that, I believe.
Well, I was trying to figure out. I thought some of our members, I'm thinking some of them are volunteer firefighters, but I don't think they smoke.
Yes, does Representative Krupp smoke?
Well, but he doesn't smoke.
Yeah, so he needs to agree to.
Yeah.
But he wears leather pants, so I think that's a similar thing. Okay.
And then the tobacco users, Senator Burdick, members of the committee, would only receive those that are listed at the top of section or on page 4, the injunctive relief, the bench trial, the costs and fees, and equitable relief.
Okay, so the tobacco users get injunctive relief, equitable relief,
costs and fees, and bench trial.
So they don't get compensatory damages.
Right.
They get everything
but compensatory damages. Basically, what I've listed what the really great remedies are under sub 3, which would include punitive damages, and this with the amendments, no one would get those. Of these three,
punitive from everybody, and the volunteer firefighters and legislators get compensatory damages, but the tobacco users don't, and everybody gets injunctive relief, equitable relief, costs and attorney's fees, and a bench trial.
Correct. Exactly.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Are there questions? I've got a list.
And members of the committee, I added a statute before you that's the firefighter statute, because the bill doesn't actually amend the statute regarding the firefighters, and some people have asked what is that firefighter statute, and so you have the separate statute in front of you. The bill has the tobacco statute and the legislative assembly member discrimination statute.
Okay, so today, if one of us went back to work and our employer didn't hire us back, what is our remedy today without this for a legislator?
Madam Chair, it's not clear in statute. Okay. And there hasn't been a judicial decision determining what it would be.
And it's also not clear for the other two categories.
Correct.
Okay. All right. I don't know why I'm very slow on this one, but I was, so I thank you for your indulgence. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Do you have something to add, Ms. Solomon?
Chair Burdick, I have nothing to add.
Thank you very much. Okay. If there's nothing to add, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 238. Where are we here? And we will open a public hearing on our last bill on our agenda, which is Senate Bill 239.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission, modifies a list of protected classes and civil rights. Civil rights laws, standardizes orders of protected classes listed in civil rights laws.
Thank you. Welcome back.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission for the record. This bill is really intended to be a cleanup bill regarding the protected classes that are listed throughout Chapter 659A of the Civil Rights Statutes in the ORS. The protected class list that most of us think of, which includes race, color, religion, sex, national origin, etc., has various classes left out throughout the statute. And those deletions seem to be an oversight, because sometimes in the same statute, all of them will be listed, and then down to subsection, one or more of them will not be listed. So I can't say that it's not a substantive change, because sometimes those words, I mean, because of how the Oregon Supreme Court interprets statutes, it is a substantive change to add in a protected class. There haven't really been court decisions saying particular statutes don't include a class. It's pretty well accepted that these classes are protected in Oregon because of the purpose statements in various statutes and, as I said, how they are listed so often in statute. So this bill is intended to provide the same classes throughout and also provide the same order, because it's just confusing to rearrange the order in different statutes. It just makes it hard to read. So that's what this bill really is. It's a cleanup bill. It does a few other things in terms of just wordsmithing and doing legislative council drafting style changes. These statutes haven't been amended for a number of years. And so, for example, the BFOQ, bona fide occupational qualification, that word is changed throughout to make it the same, instead of sometimes we call it a BFOR, instead of qualifications requirement. And just there's some wordsmithing changes that are made throughout.
Okay. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you give us a list of, you said there are changes where you've added some classes to certain statutes. Could you give us a list of where those changes are?
Senator Beyer, Chair Burdick, I'd be happy to do that. You can tell it from the bolded language, though, throughout the bill. If there's italics, we've just rearranged it. If you don't see any italics there, it means it wasn't there before, and the bolded is an addition. But usually you will see an italics there, and we've just reordered it. But in a few places, you will see that there wasn't an italics at all, and so there's a bolded word.
I see what you're saying. You reorganized them, yeah.
Right.
Are there any, I mean, we're working really from the same list of protected classes. There's nothing in here that doesn't already appear elsewhere in the statute. Is that correct? Was that your concern, Senator?
No, not specifically. I would like a list, and I understand, I know how to read statutes, but rather than having to go through them one by one, if you could give us a list that, you know, 669A, 003 added disability or something versus reorganization. That's what I'm looking for. So if you have that list that on each of these statutes, if there is something that was added, not just rearranged.
Would that be possible? Okay, fine. We'll hang on to this for that. Did you have a comment, Counselor?
Madam Chairman, as a committee, Senator Beyer, Lynn Johnson and I had the same conversation about a week ago, because I was going through the bill trying to find out the same thing. And I think when we talked, Section 11 was one of them.
It was?
On the bill, which is on page 7. And what makes it very hard is that you will go to the same section, and there will be a subsection where it's not listed. Say, for example, I think on page 8, what was added was marital status under line 6, subsection B. And then you'll go further down under 2B, and marital status is there. So there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason as to when a provision is there and the provision is not. It's not consistent. But I think, again, like on page 8, line 7 and 8, marital status was added. Actually, it's on line 10. As I said, it doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason why it was left out. It's in every other subsection there. But I think that's one where it was added.
Right.
I see familial status here, and that's separate from marital status. Okay, fine. If we could maybe get some help on that, I think that would be a helpful piece to have, because I think what we're all looking at is if there's a policy change, we want to be sure we know we're making a policy change.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's exactly the point I was trying to get to, is because normally, and I haven't seen, and I don't know when the statute was written, but in the four sessions that we have been here, legislative council doesn't make any mistakes and just leaves things out or for the heck of it.
Yeah.
And so.
All right. Well, we'll get some clarification on that. Are there other questions for the committee? Okay. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 239. And then I want to double back and I'd like to, I'm considering opening a work session on the first three bills that we had, Senate Bill 235, 36, and 37. Senate Bill 238 is still, I still want to digest that. I could certainly be talked into it, but I think I'd like to hold on that for that, to that for a while, and then we'll wait on Senate Bill 239. So unless I see active expressions of distress, I will open a work session on Senate Bill 235. Council, we do have the dash.
Madam Chair, you have the dash two amendments that came from the Law Commission, and this bill requires a place of public accommodation to remove barriers and provide auxiliary aids and services when necessary. And then dash two amendments, which were the issue as it relates to the interpretation, Commissioner of Bureau of Labor Industry shall adopt rules necessary to the administration enforcement of subsection 3 and adoption rules of subsection. The Commission shall consider, to the great extent practical, adopt regulations of the United States Department of Justice and Title III of the Americans with Disability Act. It also has an emergency clause.
Okay, thank you. Senator Starr?
Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 235.
Senator Starr has moved the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 235. Is there discussion? Senator Barr?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will oppose the motion to move these amendments. I think the bill is a better bill without the amendments. And first of all, I think this amendment probably puts the bill on cutting edge of constitutionality, you may say, because we cannot print a bill that automatically connects us to federal law. And this, with this language in it, whereas the bill will not be changing with federal law, it asks the bully to change its rules to conform with federal law, even though the statutory language doesn't specifically allow that. And I just believe this amendment puts the bill on, as I said, cutting edge. I mean, I think it's a bad amendment, and I won't support the amendment. And if the amendment goes in the bill, I may not support the bill.
Okay, I appreciate your comments. Are there other comments on this?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Starr.
My feeling is that the amendment places in the statute what has been the actual function under BOLI. Under existing law, that they have tried to provide rules that are in conformance with the federal statute, even though it was not in statute that they had that. Had that authority, perhaps. I guess I would like to have that question addressed either by council or by the folks out here.
Maybe we could bring Wendy back and ask our council to address the legal issue of having a regulatory agency revise their rules in accordance to federal statute.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my understanding is, as it relates to an improper delegation, if we reference federal law, say a federal statute, and the effective date of our bill is, say, January 1 of next year, we have referenced the federal law as of that date. So if federal law changes afterwards, we still go back to the old federal law until such a time as we update our references. As to the issue of whether BOLI can promulgate regulations on federal regulations after the effective date, I can't answer that. It's the first time. It's an issue of first impression for me.
Thank you.
Can Boley address that?
Yeah, if we could have Boley come up and address that point, the legal point that was brought up by Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the other place I'm familiar with this in statute is the Oregon Family Leave Act, where there is language that says that the Oregon Family Leave Act shall be interpreted consistently to the extent possible to be similar to the Federal Family Medical Leave Act. And I don't believe it's the exact same language that Ledge Council put in here. It's very similar language. In fact, we talked about that language at the Law Commission work group when we were talking about what language might work in this bill. And what we have done as far as our practice is we do track the developments under the Federal Family Medical Leave Act, and to the extent that that law is similar with Oregon, with the Oregon Family Leave Act, we keep our regulations updated to follow those developments. Now, it's harder in that case than I believe it would be in this case, because the legislature, when it revisited the Oregon Family Leave Act after the federal act was passed, could not come to consensus on aligning those two laws so that they were totally similar. So we have some dissimilar provisions in the state law, but to the extent that our law is like the federal law, then we have our regulations drafted accordingly. And that's as much as I can address this, but that's maybe not the legal analysis, but the real world analysis.
Counsel.
Ma'am, so are you saying that, for example, if the federal agency changes its regulations based on federal statute, because they're interpreting federal statute and they also, I assume, have delegatory regulations too, you update your regulations based on that?
Well, since the language is not exactly like this, it just says that it shall be construed consistently with the Federal Family Medical Leave Act. Where we see it necessary to change a rule or enact a rule pursuant to how the federal act is being construed, we do that. We don't always do it because, again, we don't have the specific language, the lockstep kind of language that we have here. But that's generally the approach, is keep up with the developments in that area, and Bowley interprets the OFLA law accordingly and applies it.
Thank you. Senator Starr, does this help with your concerns on this?
Well, I don't think that you've answered my question or Senator Maher's concerns, and that is regarding the disability accommodations. Is that what we're that's what we're looking at here in Senate Bill 235 is removing barriers?
Well, actually, we're talking about the rules, putting into rulemaking, putting some of the enforcement mechanism into rulemaking as opposed to statute. That was the issue.
So we're putting in the statute, and then we're turning around and saying, go ahead and change the administrative rules conform with federal legislation by this amendment?
Well, we're putting some subject areas into the regulation that that might be, well, we're putting some issues into the regulations that might be likely to change under federal law, because we're bound by federal law where it's stricter than state law. So rather than have the federal law change and have an inadequate state law between sessions until we can change it, this would allow Bowley to be more responsive to changes in federal law, and actually it would be a benefit for employers to be able to know what's required of them, because they would be bound by these changes in federal law. This would allow more rapid response to changes in federal law in between sessions.
Okay, my question is, has Bowley, without this enactment here, been promulgating rules in conformance to federal law absent this legislation?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, that is true. We have administrative rules that have already been promulgated that we adopted after the Americans with Disabilities Act was enacted. The chronology was Oregon already had a public accommodations law on the books before the federal government did. It covered public accommodation access by disabled persons. Then the Americans with Disabilities Act was enacted, and then regulations were adopted by the federal government spelling out what it meant to have access to public accommodations for disabled persons. The then commissioner of the Bureau decided to adopt rules consistent with the Americans with Disabilities Act regulations, and the authority was that the Oregon law says that the commissioner shall adopt rules to further the policy, and the policy is the use and enjoyment of public accommodations by disabled persons in Oregon. So that was the authority. I have to say, and any lawyer would have to acknowledge, reasonable minds could differ whether that was outside the authority. We continue to believe it was within the authority, but since Oregon, you know, the Oregon Court of Appeals, the Oregon Supreme Court have not visited this issue or weighed in on it, we don't know. But I would say that regardless of what one's opinion is of our authority to have the rules we now have, I believe it to be a positive step to put something in the law, because as the federal court said in some of these opinions that Ms. Johnson referred to, it doesn't look like the Oregon legislature has thought about this. They're not speaking. There's nothing in the law. We don't know what they intend. Therefore, we're going to find that there is nothing. And, you know, sometimes courts kind of put it out there to legislative bodies that hearing nothing, we're going to assume you have no thoughts on this. So, you know, you're obviously the ones who make those decisions. It's a legislative prerogative to determine whether this protection or whether these spelling out of these protections should occur. But that's, you know, that's my response, is that yes, we do currently have regulations. Yes, we do consider them enforceable.
Senator Starr, I think what may be helpful here is that with or without regulations from Boley, employers are bound by the federal law. And Boley was trying to help them figure out what the federal law required of them. This bill would actually increase the statutory authority and the statutory direction for Boley to issue regulations, so it would remove the ambiguity.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is exactly what I thought I was doing when I moved the dash two amendments. Just reinforcing what is in fact happening today, and that is notification to employers through Boley administrative rules that federal law has changed and you are responsible to that law. So I continue to support the dash two amendments, and we'll vote in favor of the dash two amendment.
Thank you. Senator Whitsitt, did you have a question?
More of a comment. Madam Chair, it appears that yet again the Bureau of Labor Industry is asking for statutory authority to authorize current practices. And I'm completely uncomfortable leaving even further rulemakings the Bureau of Labor Industries rather than crafting the needed precise statutory language that, that this bill requires.
Okay, well, I think, Senator Walker?
Yeah, I'd like to respond to that. The point is that the federal law consistently changes, Senator, and so if we put in statute and leave it static that this is the law, then our Bureau of Labor and Industries cannot keep up with the changes that take place between our legislative sessions, and then employers and persons who use public accommodations are unclear what's being done here. So I think Senator Starr got to this point that we're putting in statute what Boley's been doing, and then we leave them administrative rule authority to adapt to changes, which they always have been able to do anyway. But we're giving them, I mean, they have less, there's less for them to put in rule because we're going to put it in statute. So that's what I see about this bill.
Madam Chair, last kind of question of the Boley. The Family Leave Act in Oregon is more restrictive or more accommodating to employees than the federal act, is it not?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, in certain respects, that is true. One example would be that you get family leave for your parents-in-law under Oregon law, and you don't get that under the federal law, or for sick child leave, you get that in Oregon, you don't get that under the federal law. So, to certain extents, both laws are very complex, and so there are some areas where some would argue that there are greater rights under federal law. And to the extent that that is true, we would have to follow that, unless it comes right up against the statute and, you know, it's a complex question of interpretation. But in some respects, yes, OFLA is more generous.
Thank you. With the passage of Senate Bill 235, with or without the -2 amendments, would the state law then be more or less restrictive than the federal law when it comes to Americans with Disabilities Act and what was the other one? I guess it's just the one, right?
Public accommodation, that's it.
It would be our endeavor and interpretation that it would be the same as, to the every extent possible, that we would be having the same details about how to accommodate disabled persons in public accommodations, and right down to what we mean by that, you know, barrier removal, what does that mean, and those kinds of things. So it would be the same as, to the extent possible.
Again, thank you. If the -2 amendments are not adopted, would there be anything in the bill or in the law that would prohibit Bowley from adopting rules to keep updated with the current regulations of federal act?
You're talking about just the -2 amendments, or the bill with the -2 amendments?
The bill without the -2 amendments.
I'm just now looking at the -2 amendments because I hadn't seen them before I got here today, so I'm trying to understand.
I'd just like to. I don't believe that without the -2 amendments, there's anything that would prohibit Boulder from adopting rules as they do today. I think the Senate Bill 235 makes the law better, clearer for Oregon statute. I don't feel that same clarity is there with the -2 amendments, because you remove a section of the law with the -2 amendments, a section of the proposed change of law. That defines some things. We have Bowley and other agencies writing Minister of Rules all the time for the bills we pass. We don't have to say that the rules should conform to federal law. And I think that isn't what's on the cutting edge of constitutionality. I believe there's a key difference between this and the Oregon Family Leave Act, because our Family Leave Act is more protective of employees. So if Bowley conforms their rules to federal act, it is still less restrictive than our state act.
Well, that's with family leave, but Senator Beyer, the problem with this is if the federal law changes to become stronger, if you will, than the state law, the more protective of rights under the Americans with Disabilities Act, then the federal law in that regard would preempt state law. And if there's no way to respond to that requirement quickly through the rulemaking process, then there's no way for employers to have detailed knowledge of what new requirements they have. In other words, if the state law is stronger than the federal law, the state law prevails. If the federal law is stronger, the federal law prevails. So in a case like this where they're equal, this would, and please, lawyers, step in if you need to, but this would allow the Bowley to respond quickly to changes that affected employers without going to the legislature.
Madam Chair, I hear your explanation, and I appreciate the explanation, and I would probably agree with it with two word exceptions. If you look on page 12 of the amendment and on page 15 of the amendment, it says of 1990. So these acts, the way I read them, show that we are conforming to what these bills looked like, or the federal law looked like, as of 1990.
No. That's the name of the law. And the laws get updated all the time. It will always be called the ADA of 1990, just like it's the Clean Air Act of 1970, which has been amended many times. That's just the name.
Okay. I stand corrected.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'd also add that the dash 2 amendment adds an emergency clause that was not previously in the bill.
That's correct. Thank you for pointing that out. Okay, are there other comments? I think at this point, this is tough because this is really... Senator Prusaski, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
My take on this is basically it is codifying what is existing practice with the agency, and I think it's important to codify it to make it clear to everyone that they have the authority, restating that they already have the authority. But more importantly, I think for a business, that if they look at something that's in the state statute that does not reflect the ability to have these changes or has something, as Senator Wissett was talking about, something being very specific, very narrow, and if the federal law changes, all of a sudden you're going to have some people relying on what they see in the Oregon statute as being the law, when in reality it's not the law, because the federal law is going to always trump as a base threshold, and we cannot take away from what the feds provide as that threshold. But then going to family leave, we as a state chose as a public policy to give greater relief or whatever it may be. I just see this as a way of taking away a confusion for whoever's looking at the statutes to not have something that's so narrowly defined to think, well, we're doing everything we're supposed to do because we're based on the ORS, that's all we have to do. In reality, there's been rules that have been promulgated to reflect whatever new change there's been. And I guess there's a difference of opinion as to what we may want to have our agencies in the state doing, but the reality, I believe, even if this didn't pass, as I think what Senator Beyer was saying, they can still do it based on other rules or other authority that has been given to the agency. But this is just kind of like cleaning up the existing statutes to make it more clear as to what they're already authorized to do.
Right, and I'm racking my brain for an example. There was a recent example of the Oregon law not being updated to reflect federal requirements. Oh, it was on some kind of a federal constitutional issue. We were doing something unconstitutional. And so police officers, this was a public safety deal. What was that? It was an enforcement issue. So police officers were looking at the ORS and going out and arresting people for X offense. I can't remember what it is. And it was unconstitutional for them to do so, but it was our statute hadn't been updated yet. And so they ended up, regarded homeless people carrying signs. It was free speech protected. So it was still in the ORS. It hadn't been corrected. So they ended up with judgments against police departments because people were relying on the ORS, which were out of date. And the same analogy would play with the federals. If the federal, if Congress adopted a stronger requirement and it was still weaker in the state statute, then we would be making employers vulnerable if they didn't know that, if they were relying on the state statute. So it's up to you, Senator Beyer, but as an employer, I would hope you would...
I'm an employer.
I know you are. Okay, well, this is a policy issue, committee, and I think we're just going to go ahead and vote on this, and we may not...
So, Madam Chair, on the table is the dash 2 amendment.
It's the dash 2 amendment. Right, so okay. If there's no more discussion, we will just have a vote.
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Prusaski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo? Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
No.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye. Burdick. The dash 2 amendment is adopted. Senator Starr?
Move Senate Bill 235 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 235 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Are there objections?
Yeah. Well, it's a film to sign, actually.
Well, why don't we call the roll, and we'll see how Senator Byer comes down.
Yeah, I mean, I just, this is a tough issue now, because I think you've taken a good bill and made it worse. And I wanted to support Senate Bill 235, but I don't think it's any longer a good bill. And I guess I would disagree as an employer that having this in the statute versus having what has been the bill in the statute is clear for an employer. I think it's clear for an employer to have this in the statute. I probably would have objected to the amendment as strenuously had you not deleted lines 12 through 35 on page 2 of the printed bill. Had you left that in the bill and added this amendment, I think it would have been more palatable to me as an employer, because I, as an employer, you look to statutes. And it's easier to do that as an employer who doesn't have legal counsel to go and say, you know, hey, call my lawyer and say, I want you to update me on what the latest bowling rules are. Mm-hmm. So I'm very conflicted on this bill now, because I want to support Senate Bill 235. I think it's a good issue. I want to update our statutes, but I think you took a good bill and made it bad. So I'm going to be forced to vote against it on those grounds.
Yeah, I appreciate your explanation. I appreciate the discussion, Committee. This has been a good one. So go ahead and call the roll.
Senator Byer?
No.
Senator Brzezinski?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
No.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye. Senate Bill 235, as amended, has been adopted. Who would like to carry this? Would you like me to carry this?
Oh,
yes. Or would you like to carry this, Walker?
This is
the commissioner's job. My brain
I've done
had
this
a
before.
Lapse. My brain that. Had a lapse. Senator Walker, of course, will carry this
Absolutely.
Bill.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, you betcha.
I'm going to carry the
Senator Walker may have a bundle of them to carry here. Okay, we will now quickly open a work session on Senate Bill 236. That bill...
No amendments, Madam Chair.
No amendments on this puppy. So, Senator Starr, do you have any comments or motions to make on Senate Bill 236? This is the statute of limitations.
Right. And I, Madam Chair, move Senate Bill 236 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 236 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Are there objections? So ordered. Senator Walker, you want to carry this one too?
Sure, Madam Chair.
Okay. Make up
I
for
don't think I've carried
session.
Any bills this session yet.
Okay, we will now close the work session on Senate Bill 236 and open a work session on Senate Bill 237.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have the dash 2 amendments in front of you, and the bill sets a statute of limitations in an employment safety lawsuit. With the dash 2 amendments, it would be 1 year rather than 180 days. This is a discussion where currently there is no statute of limitations, so theoretically you could bring a suit 10 years out.
Okay. Is there a discussion? Senator Starr?
Madam Chair, I move the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 237.
Senator Starr has moved the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 237. Now is there a discussion? Are there objections? So ordered. Senator Starr?
Chair, I move Senate Bill 237 as amended to the floor to due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 237 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Are there objections? So ordered. Senate Bill 237 has been reported to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation with Senator Walker as carrier. So we are now waiting on, we're just going to hang on to Senate Bill 238 just for a bit. And Senate Bill 230, pardon?
Yeah, I'm waiting, holding both of my thoughts.
Right. And Senate Bill 239, we are waiting for a list of where the protected classes appear, where new ones appear in the statute. It's been a good discussion, committee, and we are now adjourned. We're both trying to do the right thing by you.